Got one right here.
I get it.
In the past, he has served on the board of directors for the Pine Mountain Trail Conference. So
So we have a wealth of experience going on here in front of you. And I don't want to take up too much time. I want to let folks share with you the lessons that they have learned and the inspiration they can give about what's possible at the community level. So, Lori?
Well, I was going to say, I think it's better to start with the communities.
Great.
Because they're the ones that are on the ground.
Okay.
Kind of like a mini carpet
bagger.
This door back here will not close all the way.
Uh-huh.
So if y'all could speak up, it would really help.
We're safe.
Okay, yeah, I wonder if we're just starting with the next song. But, yeah, I'll go over there and ask him. So, Teresa, do you want to give us
a start? I'll start. So, a little bit about our history. Coal, while it is a part, has been part of our heritage, one of the biggest factors in our history, or the industry itself, was the clay mines for the brickyards. And then, of course, farming with tobacco farming. So in the late 60s, early 70s, and up until probably the 80s, we still had the brickyard as an industry, but mostly in the late 60s, they started to move out. People no longer used fire-burning fireplaces in their homes. It was replaced with more modern types of heating and central heat and air and electricity, things like that. So that kind of went by the wayside, and of course, you know, with the tobacco buyout, we no longer have so many tobacco farmers, so our economy is really depleted, along with some of the timber and the coal. While I have family members, my husband worked in the coal industry building equipment, but my brother-in-law still works with the equipment in the coal industry. It's in our county, as far as mining, that's not so much. But I want to talk a little bit about some of the things we have going on in grassroots efforts. The previous administrations, at the time that the brickyards were going out, didn't really, I think it was as somebody in the session this morning talked about denial, or maybe it was last night, about is it really happening? It's not. So they didn't plan for the future. At that time, Olive Hill was pretty booming industry. There was discussion about Morehead State University being going to be located there, but it didn't happen because the administrative powers that be didn't want it to be. But anyway, I want to talk about the grassroots efforts. The Olive Hill Historical Society first started as an effort about 10 years ago to save a school. That was their intention. We had a historic building in Olive Hill. I don't know if anybody's ever been there, but there's over 100 steps that go up to the schoolhouse that sits on the hill in the center of town. It has been, you know, historically the place to be. It means a lot to people in the community. And the schools have built a new school building, let it sit in dilapidated condition. The roof of the gymnasium, when they started, was in the center of the gymnasium floor. They had no roof. So it's been an effort of love, labor of love, I guess you could say, for a very committed group of people who worked to restore the building. The building is still in renovation stages. They went through a strategic planning process several years ago because they were at the point where when we get this building renovated, you know, they're a historical society. They didn't set out to be a building owner, but what do they do with it? So in the planning process, they determined that the school represented education, and arts was something that people in our community, we have a lot of local artists and musicians, and they felt like that the building still needed to be used for arts and education. So that became their mission, that it was the Olive Hill Center for Arts and Education. And that's really good, and they're working to renovate it, but they had no business plan of how to sustain this building. It cost money to operate. You know, they're spending money every month for now alarm systems, the electrical power that has to be on in the building. So how do they manage to do that? So they are now going through a business planning process to determine how can they bring in enough money to support the mission of the organization and still be able to utilize the building. So that's where they are with that. Another organization I'm involved with is called the Olive Hill CPR, or Council for Planning and Restoration. If you caught the CPR, that was intentional. The group was formed immediately following the 2010 floods. We had two floods that came back to back, one on May 2nd and one July 21st, that flooded our town. Probably about 90% of the businesses in our community were affected by the flood. Our Senior Citizen Center had over 6 feet of water in it, along with the other businesses and buildings on Railroad Street. We had had some flooding in the past, but it was not to that extent. As you can imagine, if any of you have gone through flooding, a lot of our businesses did not have flood insurance, and FEMA will have individual assistance, but not business assistance, as far as money that they would not have to pay back. They did offer some low-interest loans, but most of the people who could do that, some of them didn't come back. They said, I already have a loan at the bank on my merchandise, and I can't afford to go back and borrow money again to replace it. So a lot of those businesses didn't come back after the flooding. But one of the things that came out of that was we asked Lori to come in as a Main Street group to come in and talk to our businesses. We felt like we needed some revitalization. We thought she could help us. And so she came to a community forum. The female representatives happened to be there. She did such a great job. They asked her to come back, and we had several more series of community forums. And out of that, we formed a community volunteer group that serves as a catalyst to find the necessary people, the necessary officials that might be able to get things done that we have in our community. So through this process, there were 12 project areas that were determined that we really needed in our community, ranging from economic development to housing to revitalization of downtown or relocating the major downtown areas, beautification, outdoor activities, all of those sorts of things. And so since then, some of the things that the Olive Hills CPR group have been involved in is, out of that, one of the main issues was the drug problem. That was one of the first issues we attempted to tackle. We were able to get a grant through the Brushy Fork Institute, and we held it was a youth drug program called Screen and Clean that was modeled after another community who had done a similar thing, which was really good for us, brought a lot of light. We had some forums to talk about some of the activities for youth, and there was drug testing at the school. The parents agreed to drug test their children. They got a t-shirt that said, I've been screened and cleaned. If it came back bad, they were actually offered counseling. We had community partners that helped us with that. So that was one of the issues. Another thing that we've taken on is the Trail Town Initiative. So we have a Trail Town Task Force that gets together on a monthly basis, who have developed trails throughout our community, leading to the state park, leading to Grayson Lake area, all over the town, so that we can have recreational activities, non-motorized recreational activities, horseback riding, cycling, hiking, biking. Did I already say biking? but we're hoping to become a Kentucky trail town, so we're working toward that with signage. And this is a very active group. It brought in people that normally, I work in a lot of groups, and I'm sure a lot of you are in the same situation. Volunteers, you see the same people at different groups and organizations. You have the same people who are taxed out with all of the. This brought in a lot of new people. You know, the horseback riders we didn't usually see at community type meetings, so that was really good. And it also fit with one of the project areas for the CPR group that we had determined, which was more outdoor family-friendly activities. And it also brought in a tourism aspect for economic development. There's a merchant group with this that ties in the local businesses to that. Another thing that we've been working on is the Community Foundation Initiative, much like Jerry Roll talked about, you know, the philanthropy aspect, the out-migration, the wealth, the transfer of wealth that's going from our county that, you know, may not come back. I can think of a lot of people in our community who their children have moved away, probably not coming back, and their parents passed away, and that money leaves our town. Our local banker said within 5 days, you know, somebody comes in and takes the money out, and it goes away and does not come back. records. We need to be able to capture that, and that's one of the things we've been working on. Another initiative in the Grayson area that's kind of piggybacking on some of the things that we've done, it's a community partner, so they're trying to bring together a lot of different community groups. They're having some forum meetings. They intend to have a summit, and that's bringing people together who can actually... It's one thing to get a group of people together that say, I'd really like to, you know, this to happen. I think we need this in our community. But you have to have people there who can make it happen or that can have a role in making that happen. So trying to make sure that those partners are involved in it too, that someone who actually can, you know, whether it's your elected officials or, you know, a healthcare agency that can have some, you know, effect with healthcare, or somebody with child care that can make those things happen. And another organization I want to talk about quickly is FEET, Foothills Eco Agritourism. It's a 5 counties. We talked about crossing the county lines. This is it's about networking with your local businesses across those county lines for tourism, artists, craftsmen, on-farm businesses, activities like zip line or, you know, four-wheel parks, anything that you can think of. There's a winery that's involved in this group. It's Carter, Elliott, I think it's Morgan, Menifee, and Wolf that are involved in this initiative. And they do training for local, for the businesses, whether it's strategic planning for the businesses, web page design, social media training. They brought in a photographer to show them how to take pictures of their items or their business to post online for social media or on their web pages. So it's a support network, and I remember one of the sessions that I was at, there were 3 different businesses in the group. By the time they finished for the week's training activities, they were already partnering together to do things. So they were printing up brochures or pamphlets and passing those out of each other's businesses. And that was in the Red River Gorge area, so that they could network and say, hey, you know, while you're here in our area visiting, go to this business too. I don't know if they offered discounts, but certainly they were already networking together and finding a benefit in it. They also offer a conference every year, this year's conference is going to be in July. I wish I could tell you the dates for sure. I don't know that, but look for the information on that coming up. And I just close by saying that, you know, sometimes we run across political issues. Don't give up. Just keep, you know, persistence pays off. Just like with the Historical Society, you know, there's always the naysayers out there that are going to say, you know, you can't do that, people won't change. Persistence does make it happen. And if you ever find yourself getting down, list all of the activities you've done, and then you'll come back and say, we really have accomplished a lot. It may seem like that you don't get a lot done, but when you look back at that list, you really have. And that was something that with the CPR we found out whenever we went back. We were actually working on a grant application, and we're trying to tie in with some of the things we'd already accomplished. And when we wrote it down, it was like, wow, have we really done all that? And so then it's worth, you know, give yourself a pat on the back, but don't ever give up. Just keep plugging along, because you'll get there.
I'm Amelia Kirby, and thank y'all for being here today. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with y'all. I live and work in Whitesburg, Kentucky, which is in Letcher County, just over Pine Mountain. I work at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, which is a nonprofit law firm that does work around coal mining issues. But I also co-own with my husband a cafe and bar and music venue and art gallery called Summit City, and it's in the heart of downtown Whitesburg. And we've been really involved in working on trying to figure out what ways the town of Whitesburg really, and by extension Letcher County, by extension the coal fields of Kentucky and Appalachia, but, you know, really focusing in our work specifically on the town of Whitesburg, what ways we can create sustainable models so that as we're in this transitional moment, as coal is shifting in the national economy and certainly shifting in our local economy, what's going to be here for the people who want to stay in Appalachia, want to stay in the mountains? How do we make places that we can and want to live? So Whitesburg is a town of about 1,300 people. It's a pretty small town, and Letcher County is about 25,000 people. So it's a small town in a small place. Many of you all have ever been there. It's a very lovely town, sits at the base of Pine Mountain, beautiful view, and a really nice historic downtown that had really gotten very neglected, very run down. There wasn't a lot left in the downtown. There was one wonderful anchor business, the Courthouse Cafe in Cozy Corner, which I recommend everybody to go to, that's been there for a long time and has been an inspiring business for those of us who were kind of looking at downtown revitalization. My husband is from Perry County, Vico, Kentucky, and I grew up in Wise County, Virginia. We kind of both moved to Whitesburg separately in 2000 and found each other, to our delight. And he's a biologist. He has an environmental consulting company. And he had expanded enough that he actually needed an office space, not our back bedroom anymore, and decided that he would like to buy a building in the downtown, which they were all pretty dilapidated and certainly very cheap, which made it possible for us to do that. So we got this building, and as we're sort of peeling back the layers for his offices on the top floor, we started doing the same on the bottom floor. And as the carpet and paneling and drop ceilings came off, there was this incredibly beautiful historical space underneath with beautiful wood floors and original tin ceiling, and it just really kind of called out to have something done with it. I was working full-time at Apple Shop at the time. He obviously had his business. So it seemed like a great and logical idea to open a restaurant. That just seemed a perfect conclusion. So we did, with the help of his mom, who had worked in the industry before. So we kind of had a family business, and we were not at all ambitious. Our opening hours, the first couple or 3 years we were open, were 7 a.m. to midnight, 6 days a week. So we really set the bar a little bit higher than was even remotely sane, but managed to pull it off. And in that setting the bar and figuring out what we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it and why we wanted to do it, one of the kind of guiding principles for us is, what do we leave town? When we leave Whitesburg, what do we leave for? Because we left town most weekends. And it was to go eat at good restaurants. It was to go drink good cocktails and good beer, see live music, go to art galleries. Those are all the things that we left to go to Lexington or Knoxville or Asheville to do. And so we figured we should try to put all of those things into this very low ambition business. And so, in fact, we've managed more or less to incorporate all of those elements in it. We do have, every 2 months, we rotate local art through the walls. We have an amazing mural that Pam O'Fumi here painted on our back deck. So we kind of try to maintain a really constant presence of visual art from the region. We have live music every Wednesday night. We have an open mic night every Saturday. We have touring bands. And we've managed to actually really get a pretty good reputation in the touring music community, so you're able to pull in acts that would not necessarily be playing a town of 1,200 people otherwise. And we have tasty food, and the main thing, we sell alcohol. And I think that's been the key piece that has made all of it possible. The city of Whitesburg went wet. We just the city, Letcher County is still dry, went wet right at the same time we were deciding to take this on. And what it's meant for us, you know, as a business, it's basically pays the bills, in as much as the bills get paid. But it for the development of Whitesburg and the development of a community identity and a space that said this place is not dying necessarily, it opened up a place that people were coming to that were not talking to each other and not crossing paths and not sharing space in any other part of the community. So, you know, if somebody wants a cold beer, and you're the only place that sells cold beer in the town, you're going to end up with people who are sitting at the bar together, you know, shooting the breeze and finding common ground and finding reminders that this is a place that is still living and breathing and it's got some kick left to it. So I think a lot of times in a lot of our communities in the region, alcohol can be a kind of a controversial issue, but I really have seen the way that it changed Whitesburg. It doesn't have to be vulgar or rowdy or wild. I mean, you know, people, although sometimes it is. But it really does, I think, make a space in a different way than a lot of other community spaces that exist. And it's a place of camaraderie that's made a big difference in Whitesburg. And since we've been open, there's been, I think, 5 or 6 other businesses that have opened in downtown Whitesburg, including another bar, which is great. Because I think the more places you have to come, the more people come to be in those spaces. So that's been a really positive thing. A bakery that did our breakfast this morning here has opened in the last 6 months. And a couple of clothing businesses use, like, consignment clothes. And so there's been just sort of energy and motion and activity in downtown. And so the pieces, I think, that have been important to that, there's certainly the alcohol as a catalyst, but I also think that there's a lot of power in the idea that neither Joel nor I is from Letcher County, which is challenging in a lot of ways because people are like, oh, you're not from here. We're like, well, we're from 30 minutes from here, but you're not from here. But what that means is that we're in no way entrenched in the power structures and the power dynamics of the community. So people, the kinds of patterns that are real barriers for community building didn't exist in the space that we created because we didn't know who anybody was or wasn't, you know, and what those historical sort of holding power or barriers to shared power were in the community. So I think that there was a way that was a significant space that got created just in some ways through ignorance, although I would have chosen it if I'd known how, but, you know, it's just kind of a space that emerged in that way. But also I think that the other piece is that there's such deeply entrenched lowered expectations for Appalachia and Eastern Kentucky. I mean, people think, oh, that's not possible. You can't have, you know, an elegant cocktail, and you can't have, you know, fresh and unusual foods. People aren't going to want those things. People aren't going to want good beer. They're not going to want a pretty space. They're not going to hear music that they haven't heard before. And what we found is people absolutely want those things, and that this sort of lowered expectations hold us back just phenomenally, effectively. And the example that I use sometimes is that, you know, we have hummus on our menu. We make our own hummus, and when we open, people are, what the hell is that? And why would I eat it? And now, you know, I have this image, you know, like this, you know, a friend of ours who's a coal miner, gets off work, comes in, covered in coal dust, orders a hummus platter and a Bud Light, you know, and doesn't bat an eye. And so, you know, those shifts happen, and they happen because people are encouraged to try new things, but also are very willing to try new things and are willing to prove that the lowered expectations are ridiculous. So that's a little bit about Whitesburg and
real good music and food, too. Very good.
I'm Tim Belcher. I'm from Elkhorn City, Kentucky. And I'm loading up some images here because I can't speak or talk about Elkhorn City, Kentucky without showing pictures. It's like a lot of communities in Eastern Kentucky. I think it's one of the most beautiful areas and cities that are around here. I couldn't help but notice this morning a lot of the talk centered around water. And water for the organization that I head is real important, especially in Elkhorn City. And you can see why. Because that's water, and that's real water, and it's white water. And one of the things that we are blessed with in Elkhorn City, Kentucky, is the Russell Fork of the Big Sandy, which provides class 4 and 5 white water in October. And it's really interesting to see fellows from New Zealand who will come all the way over here just to run this gorge and are willing to sleep in a gravel pit to do it. So it's one of the things that Elkhorn City has to offer. So we started seeing this happening, and we started trying to think of ways to, you know, capitalize on our whitewater, because we have a resource around here in Appalachia of water that is amazing. Now, how we got started, we started doing some things as simple as highway markers. If you see this highway marker here, you know, I ask people, if I ask any Kentuckian, when Daniel Boone came through Kentucky the first time, how did he get here? Anybody tell me? He went through Elkhorn City. You're right. But most people are going to say, well, they come through the Cumberland Gap. Yeah. But so we try to do small things like this highway marker. Daniel Boone's first steps was through the Breaks Gorge and into Elkhorn City in 1767. He didn't come through the Cumberland Gap until 1769. He went to David and Floyd County, wintered, came back. So, you know, we're trying to get back a little more of our heritage. And the cultural heritage tourist and the adventure tourist are the keys to what we're trying to do. And we're trying to do both together. So this is the dedication of the Daniel Boone First Steps Highway Marker. Jesse Stewart, my mother, is one of the gray-headed ladies there. But Jesse was instrumental in getting the history for this. Now, this is a view of Elkhorn City. I did this presentation once at a Rotary Club meeting, and I said, you know, I love this beautiful town. The only problem is all these gas wheel scars. I didn't realize I was speaking to Rotary, so I've never been back to Rotary in time. But that's okay. But this was taken in 01. In 01, we had natural gas came into Elkhorn City and started just drilling everywhere. So we had issues evolving around that. That kind of solidified our organization, too. But you see how the river snakes through downtown. And one of the things that communities in Eastern Kentucky need to do is capitalize on our rivers and how they come through downtown. You know, I'm from Pike County. Pike was the county seat. One of the most horrible things I've ever think has happened in Eastern Kentucky is Pike will literally cut down a mountain and move the river. And it's crazy. When you go to San Antonio, Texas, if you've ever been to San Antonio and been on the Riverwalk, they have a creek, what we would call a creek.
Yeah.
In San Antonio, the Riverwalk. But, you know, they get 28 million visitors a year in San Antonio. They got the Alamo and that river. Okay. Las Vegas gets 32 million visitors a year. They have to build casinos and have gambling to do it. You can take the river and revitalize your community if you do it right. Elkhorn City has a lot of trail assets, and she talked about Trail Town. We're also in the Trail Town certification process. We're kind of ahead of other communities because you have to build connecting trails to get downtown and teach your merchants how to be good to trail users. And I go around town telling merchants why they should have a bike rack in front of their business, and they look at me with a starry eye. Mm-hmm. You know, because you want to be invited to trail users. We're on the 76 Transamerica Trail. We've been on that trail since 1976. It's a cross-country bicycle trail. We see 700 to 1,000 bicyclists come through our town a year. Now, the restaurants see it. They're real good about it. They know what that means. We have the Breaks Interstate Park. We're 5 miles. Well, actually, the city of Elkhorn City and the Breaks are right. Our city line and the Breaks is right there. So we're right next to it. The Pine Mountain Trail State Park. The Great Eastern Trail, which is coming through. Russell Fork River Trail. And then back in one of the first things we did, and I have to give a lot of credit to Apple Shop, is back in around 2000, we were picked as one of the communities for the Art and Democracy Project here in Eastern Kentucky. 5 towns were picked. And we had some artists come in here and actually help us. We developed a little blue line art trail around the river. And it's an exercise everyone should go through. Because when we threw that blue up on that wall, the bitching was enormous, okay? But it was invigorating, but it was enormous. But why North Carolina blue? So we had this conversation about how, well, the blue represents water and the mountains and, you know, the relationships, and you get to have a conversation with people. Now, if I tried to go take that down, the bitching would be enormous. Okay, after 10 years. So, and all these artists were from California. The other thing we need to get here in Eastern Kentucky, and it's starting to get better, is our local universities need to tie into our communities. Our local universities are tied into the extraction industries, okay, and education along that way, but they're not tied into the communities. We developed a river plan from people from Cal Poly in California, but I can't get people from Morehead State. Now, there's an exception to that because Lori came to Elkhorn in 2008 and helped us do a strategic plan. But she would be one of the first people to tell you that also, that there's university professors out there and they're looking for projects. There's grad students who are looking for theses. They're looking for work to do. Right now I'm trying to work with Eastern Kentucky University in their Parks and Recreation Department because I think Elkhorn City is the perfect lab. If you've got a science department, you need a lab. If you've got a Parks and Recreation Department, you need a lab. And we have it all. This is downtown and the little Blue Line Trail area where people can just walk around, look at some art, and enjoy the downtown. And that's the river going through town. The other thing that we've done as a community, and this was kind of unique, we had some fellows who were with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Okay? So they're passionate people. How do we dance around with them? How do we get something done? Well, we ended up having a Civil War reenactment in Elkhorn on Memorial Day. And it's now the second largest Civil War reenactment in the state of Kentucky. Only Prairie Hills won't be there. Now, we have 100 to 150 reenactors show up. They get a camp on the river. Then they get to shoot it out with each other on Saturday and Sunday. And we have 3,000 people come downtown to watch it those 2 days. It's literally amazing. And it's actually given people a reason to stay in town on Memorial Day rather than to leave. Now, that's just an annual event. But when people see that, they can see how events do matter. The picture in the bottom right-hand corner is just the crowd. We have to close down the road. They're looking at the Civil War. You can see the camp there by the river. The reenactors love it. They get to come down in their camp. They get to swim in that river. So what we've been trying to do is take different parts of the puzzle with the natural assets that we have, whether it be whitewater, which is our key asset, hiking, camping, fishing, the Russell Fork from the Virginia state line to Elkhorn City is one of the most pristine waterways in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. After Elkhorn City and Elkhorn Creek, it gets a little worse, but the white water there is, you know, the fishing's great too. We have people come in to fly fish. There's trout in it. We are ATV friendly like Everett's. We're trying to develop that in too. And these are all pieces of a puzzle that we can make work. But if you've never ridden a raft or been in a kayak, it's something you have to do. There's no better thrill. I mean, I'm telling you, there's no better thrill. But you can see, one of the things we realized about the paddling, the kayakers, is in October when we know there's going to be a release, we know there's going to be water from Flanagan Dam because they've got to get down to winter. So in October, we literally have people from New Zealand, Australia, Alaska. They all come to here to paddle this river because it's one of the best in the eastern United States. That's 5% of the kayakers. That's the extreme athletes that do this. Okay? It's not where the money is. Okay? So as a community, we're trying to figure out how can we get, you know, a class 3 boater to here. And one of the things we've come up with is to actually go in the river, tweak some spots, We've had a feasibility study done on it. McLaughlin Group did it for us. They're the same group that built the kayak course for the Atlanta Olympics. And we found out there's some minimal things we can do that are environmentally friendly and tweak the river and make the play spots and put in play holes along downtown Elkhorn City in River Rock Park and do some riverfront development that way. What we found out when we look at these parks, and this is for every boater or tuber or swimmer that's in the water, you're going to have 15 to 20 people watching. We've got two bridges right there that they can watch it from. So when you have that kind of activity going on downtown around water, it's going to help. I don't know if it's as good as getting a drink, but it's mighty close. And, you know, if we can get a drink added into it, we're there. and, you know, this is the kind of thing that you can see doing. Now, this would be built so that people could use it, you know, 9 months out of the year. All we need is a little flow from Flanagan on guaranteed weekends, which we had some luck. They're getting ready to do a whole big sandy watershed study that'll help us get that. We've been fighting with the Corps for 10 years to try to get more water in October. So, you know, and every town's got a river. They may not have the white water that this river offers. This is not the Cumberland, is it? What's out here?
Yeah,
it is a Cumberland, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was thinking about that. You know, just driving, I know it's full right now, but just driving over the mountain, I'm thinking, man, I'd love to jump in there. I could have probably gotten here quicker if I just rode. And Elkhorn City's thing is water, and I think it can be Eastern Kentucky's thing too, and more in multiple ways. I'm not going to bore you with this user survey stuff. But the other, and let me say in closing, that the other thing that we're trying to do with our young people is develop an entrepreneurial spirit. And what I found out is most of them actually have it. The internet, they see what's out there. So they don't have some of the negative impacts that their parents do. There's not as much resistance to, you know, they realize they're not going to go to work for GM and work for 40 years and get a retirement. They know they're going to work 10 to 12 jobs. So they're not resistant to being an entrepreneur. So a lot of this comes with entrepreneurial coaching and just telling a young kid what they can do. I've got one kid that I try to work with. His grandmother had an old building in Elkhorn. He's an artist. That's what he wants to do. You know, he adores Hunter S. Thompson. I said, you know, me and you can talk a lot of things. And I said, you know, why don't you try to bootstrap this? I said, why don't you take $100 and try to do this gallery? So the first thing he does is go over to Summit City and see what's going on over there, gets inspiration, comes over, and he's starting. You know, he's going to open in May with his art gallery. So there's things that sometimes we just got to talk to these kids and give them a little one-on-one time. And that's actually how we can make the transition and keep them here. Because they actually all want to stay here. Because it doesn't get any better than Eastern Kentucky as far as, you know, it's just a great place to live.
So I'm Laura Garkovich, and I'm a state extension specialist at UK in the College of Ag, in a department called Community Leadership Development. And when I'm wearing my extension hat, what I do is I work with communities and organizations doing strategic planning, community visioning, and capacity building. And so I'm kind of, I'm the carpetbagger that comes in from outside, but not to tell you what you want to do, but to provide a process wherein you can determine and discover what you want to do. And that's basically what I do with communities. But I want to kind of capture some things here, and so from that, what they're commenting and what I've observed. So I want to ask you guys a question. Did anybody wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a civic leader?
That's true. Okay. That's not the way it happens. Civic leaders emerge because they are people who see something that needs to be done and realize that if they don't do it, no one else will. And they have a passion and a commitment about that thing. And I know, Teresa, I know so many others, Lola Thomas, Menifee County, Linda Adkins in Elliott County, I can just name off a whole bunch of them, that are people who just say, look it, I go back to the old, if you're old enough to remember the old network, movie network, where the guy threw open the window, he said, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. And that's where they've gotten to. They say they see the potential, and they have a passion for change, and they know that if they don't do it, the community will continue to keep sliding back. And so they are willing to put themselves on the line, to take a risk in order to inspire others to be with them. And that is what civic leaders, civic entrepreneurs do. And if your community doesn't have one, then it's going to be very hard because to make change until you find one or two people who are willing to put themselves on the line to be those leaders. Passionate, they see community needs as more important than their personal needs. They see, there's just a whole set of things that define them. These need to be grassroots efforts, and in each case here, you've heard that. And in every other case that I've worked in where I've seen change occur, it's because, not because some egghead from the university or the state came in and said, you really ought to do this. It's because people in the community thought about what it is they wanted to become, developed a plan to become it, and then put themselves to work to make it happen. The only dreams that come true are the dreams that come from you. I go home at night. How many times have I said this to people in the communities I work with? I mean, I've worked with Carter County a lot in the last couple of years, but I say, look, I'm going to go home and work in my community as a citizen. Are you willing to do the same for yours? And that's really what these are, grassroots efforts. But, and here's what you did with yours. Probably, I don't think you sat down and said, well, we want to open up create a public space wherein people of different backgrounds and experiences can come together and meet on neutral ground and enjoy themselves but have good conversation. Is that what you said when you, no, right. But that's what these efforts need. They need neutral public spaces where people can have conversations and meet and talk about things and feel that it's safe to talk about even the most wildest idea, like in your two cases, becoming damp or wet, hot issues in these communities. Something that that Teresa especially talked about in the context of their facing the two disasters back-to-back was learning to navigate the legal, the political, and the regulatory landscape. I don't know how many times I've encountered, and you're doing it in the sense of, because I remember that discussion, and talking about, you guys talking about your vision, that the possibilities you could do with that river, if only, and it's taken you a long time to navigate that Corps of Engineers, which I just want to say, amazing to it. That's like moving, that's worse than moving. I don't know. So great, congratulations. But you have to learn to, here's the thing, if you don't learn to navigate it, all you're going to be is a billy goat hitting an immovable rock. So you can't make it move. You got to figure out how to create a situation where it wants to move for you. And that's what you do when you work with the Corps of Engineers or the state or the feds or whatever. So in Menifee County, after they had done all this work to rebuild and create Broke Lake Falls, and then the tornado last year came and wiped it out. I mean, literally went right through the middle of it, tore everything down that they had worked on, all the trees and everything else. And they had hiking paths that they had created by hand and the labor of love of volunteers. And they were being told by the state government and the feds that they couldn't go in and clean those paths up because of some environmental regulations. And they just said, okay, let's just talk about this. And they took the effort to bring these people there and said, now tell us how we're supposed to, how are we supposed to have a path if we can't, oh, well, you know, they, but they learned how to make them understand their situation. And so they made them into partners rather than obstacles. And that you have to do that. I heard about raising expectations for ourselves in order to surprise others and sometimes ourselves. And that's what you were talking about in terms of thinking back, Dr. Teresa, in terms of the community. Somebody said it earlier, we do deserve the best, and we need to believe in ourselves. And I would argue that I cannot tell you how many communities I've worked in where, this is the honest, in this one. And it wasn't Northeast Kentucky, it wasn't in Carter County, but I did tell you guys the story, where I was the first question for a summit that we were having in the community. We had 70 people in the room, and I was up there, and I had my flip charts, and I said, okay, let's start, kind of like, let's start this off. Again, let's go talk about this. Tell me what it is that's great about this community and what you do well. And I waited at the flip chart. Nearly 3 minutes went by. And I'm standing waiting. And then from the very back of the room comes this little voice that says, we fight among ourselves pretty well. and yeah, we do. And I live in Woodford County, and I'll tell you, we fight among ourselves really well. I mean, we work classic at it. But you know, change doesn't happen when we see everybody else as an enemy, when we don't see the common interest that we have. And in the communities that I have worked in, the real progress has been when people have said, hey, your city, I'm county, but somehow we're occupying the same geographic space. We're in the same sandbox. Maybe that says something about how we ought to play together. And find ways to overcome decades or sometimes a century of hostile feelings about which sometimes when I ask them, why don't you like those people, they can't even tell me why, they just know that they don't. So we've got to, in these communities that I've seen where things have changed and are happening, people start reaching out to each other. They see themselves as being worthy of doing something. They see each other as worthy partners, not just opponents. Engaging youth is something else. You didn't even talk about that, but there's a, yeah, that's okay, but there's a youth CPR group, and they've been really active. They have a youth outreach group, and they're getting ready. I mean, they're planning their own space now, their own physical space. But let me tell you, as someone who's taught at UK since 1976, which means I'm really, really old, the students of today are not at all like the students of the 80s. When the only thing I ever heard from them, when I said, what do you want to do when you leave this place? They'd say, I want to get a job that gets a lot of money, where I can make a lot of money and retire when I'm 40. Today, when I ask that question, what they tell me is, I want a job that is personally fulfilling. I want to live in a place where I can raise my family and spend time with my family. And I want a job that allows me to do that. Youth are brilliant. They are, and I'm talking about, I never do any kind of visioning process that doesn't include youth. And I have trained kids as young as fifth graders to go back into their own schools and lead a discussion about what they want for the future. And they come back with brilliant ideas. So, you know, I'm tired of people saying, well, we want to make this a better community for our children, and then say, oh, but we're not going to ask them what they want. Come on, folks. So they have got to be partners with us. They want to be partners with us. They crave that opportunity. Let them help us build it. And finally, it's about networking and partnerships. We've got to find, in the communities, I know this, you didn't even talk about a whole arts thing that's going on in Elkhorn City that's making it just like a really, I mean, a fabulous place. Yeah. And what, in a lot of our community, let me ask this question. In your county, are there wonderfully happy relationships between city and county governments? And Teresa can say this. Yeah, I mean, they're tougher because they've got both Greenup and Olive Hill and county governments, so they got three of them, you know. Here's the thing, guys. We have to build. We are all going to get there together. We cannot build an island called Olive Hill successful and economically vital and great place to live, floating in a sea of poverty and poor environmental quality and miserable quality of life and poor health. Okay? We're all in this together. And what I'm seeing is the places that are moving forward fairly rapidly are the places where they have finally reached across lines and said and understood that not only within this county are we in it together, but, oh my God, maybe across the county line we're in it together. And I mean, that's what's even like more mind-boggling for a lot of reasons. All I know is that I only go where people ask me to go, because that's just the way extension is. That we have a lot more resources than we realize, and we need to learn to value our resources, our assets, all the wonderful things that we have, as much as those people from New Zealand or who come back after being away for 50 years in San Francisco or Alaska and say, now I remember why this place is home. That's what we need to get. So those are the things that I see that kind of cut across the kind of conversations about the communities that make transitions.
Well, I'm sure there are a number of questions from our amazing panelists. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. And Laura, you kind of, I was going to give a little summary and you did it for me, so.
Okay, great.
Thanks. No, I appreciate
that's what
you wanted. No, yeah. But doing it at the end was really helpful. So open it up for questions and answers.
There's no set program in place in our community except the MAIST has a program,
yes,
don't they?
If you didn't say that, I would.
But the way I've always approached kids that wanted to do something is I really try to get them to bootstrap it and just think their way around it, and it usually becomes something better than what they were thinking of, because there's a whole generation of people out there who are making money and living alternate lifestyles economically because they bootstrapped a blog or how they live or, you know. And I try to turn these kids on to those people, whether it be Tim Ferriss, who wrote the 4-Hour Work Week, or some of these other fellows. And once they start seeing that outside, they come up with ways to make it happen. Now, sometimes they have to have a hard asset to help them. But I think MACE is probably the best for that.
Sure. So, you know,
MACE
is a community development finance institution, which means it's like a bank, but it's a nonprofit, and it exists. One of our programs, our enterprise development program, exists to do lending to entrepreneurs who want to start businesses in Eastern Kentucky. And we can also put you in touch with other resources to help you develop business plans. I can tell you that there are a lot of sources of capital out there, including the banks, which have got a lot of money right now. But in order to access the capital, you have to have a business plan that's viable. And so that's really the first hurdle, is getting a viable business plan together. And you have to talk with anybody who wants to learn more about it.
And the small business development centers that are scattered around the state are a great place to go for help with developing those business plans. But the other thing is, I'm going to be kind of like a little crap that I know that now, but I'm going to say that, that we need to encourage local banks to reinvest in the community by thinking about how they can help entrepreneurs. And then the other piece of information is to understand that some national studies suggest that for most entrepreneurs, well over half of their startup income comes from friends and family. And that it's kind of like you ask up the people you know to invest in you and your idea. And if they are confident enough to do that, then going to a bank or a formal source is much easier, because you can say, hey, you know, my family and friends are willing to take the risk with me also. And so that helps kind of like, you know, sell the idea.
Yeah, and as a practical matter, often what we see with businesses and startups is that it might not be the friend or family member actually putting up the money, but maybe they co-sign for the loan. So they're putting the collateral into the deal that makes the loan
yeah.
viable.
Frankfurt is getting ready to start, I can't remember their official name for it, but I call it the Entrepreneur in the Window program. But literally, it's from Durham, North Carolina. It's an idea that started there. Essentially, they find a window front on Main Street that is big enough to put in just a super mini office. And then they invite applications from people to be in that window and run their entrepreneurial business there for a certain period of time. They have to make a video presentation, they have to have a business plan, all that kind of stuff. Then they select them. And then the local people, organizations and groups, they donate. And if you donate the chair or the customer and somebody else donates, you get your name is placed on the bottom of the window so that everybody can see that you've done it. The person who is providing the window space donates it to the chamber, so they get a tax, you know, they make a default info to a 501c3, and the person gets a year of activity. And they were saying that they're going to be doing theirs in the pizza parlor, because that was the guy who wanted to do it in Frankfurt. The one in Durham, the first one, was in a cafe, and they said that the cafe owner said his business increased because people will be walking by, stand there, and look at this guy working in the front window. And say, what's going on? Or his customers would come in, and clients would come in and sit down and have some coffee before they went for their meeting or, you know, with him. But it's just, I'm just saying that there are so many. Justin was right. It's not that we lack ideas. It's just like, it's that we're not necessarily sure how to get them started. And what I would say is, you see in front of you right here, these are the people, you need people like this who are willing to say, we can get the idea started, and I'm going to do it if no one else wants.
I was giving you a switch.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it kind of builds off of this. It's a question I listened to the Elkhorn City story, which reminds me, a number of communities that I've worked in over time where people come together around some ideas to make their community more attractive, more interesting, more inviting. And this can be, it may be led by a chamber, it may be led by a development organization, it might be park cleanups, it might be trails. You can do a lot of initiatives like that through sort of public sector efforts or nonprofit efforts. But this goes back to something I learned about tourism. Most of what I know about tourism, I learned from this guy that had a rafting livery in southern West Virginia. He said people come in with a pair of cutoffs and a $20 bill, and they leave with a wet pair of cutoffs and a wet $20 bill, and the trick is to figure out how to get the $20 bill away from them while they're there. And if you think about communities that want to do tourism, it's all about getting the $20 bill away from them. So you may have a beautiful place, but you've got to have places to eat, places to stay, and things to do, or people will drive through there and go, boy, that's a pretty place, on down the road.
Places to rent a canoe, or a kayak, or a raft.
Or to eat and drink.
To eat and drink.
But so the question I have is, how do you create the interface that results in not just the creation of the interesting place, but stimulates the businesses in that place that will then capitalize on the opportunity that you've created? Because you can make things happen in the public sector. You can go out and get a Flex and Grant or whatever and do your project, but you can't make somebody start a business. You can lead a horse to water. And so I don't know if there's an actual answer to this so much as I just wanted to hear some reflections on that from you all and what you see in the communities.
In Olive Hill, I've been working with the Main Street organization for a number of years, and a lot of us, you know, there are the naysayers there, and there, when the ordinances we were working on, historic ordinance for the downtown, it's been difficult to get the buy-in, particularly from some of those businesses that have been there for years. They don't want change. They don't adapt well. They still think of the town as when it was in the 60s, and they want it to be that way again, and it's not going to be. It's a different place, and we can't go back there. We don't have that industry anymore. It can be a vibrant place, but it's going to look different. And, you know, we would have activities, and we had two restaurants side by side. One served burgers and fries. The other one was a pizza place. We had a downtown event, downtown movie night at the depot. People could cross the street. We actually, I think, blocked it off for a while, and we had a car show that day also. It was really neat to go down, you know, the back street and see all these old cars parked there, and people were just walking around everywhere. One of the restaurants set up a few tables outside and capitalized on the business. The other place complained that people couldn't get there to pick up their pizzas, and their delivery driver couldn't get in on the street. You know, they could have sold pizza by the slice and made a lot more money than selling a whole pizza, you know, charge $3 for a pizza slice and, you know, $5 for the whole thing. But they didn't. It's how do you, no, I don't know. It was pretty frustrating. You have some that, you know, there was another pizza place around the corner that said that was one of the best nights they had, you know. You have a band playing, and people would come in there, and they talked about that. But, you know, I don't know. It's you get support from some and none from the others. And we're, you know, struggling with the idea, too. But how do you get those businesses who really need it, how do you get them involved in it? And you invite them to your meetings, you ask their input, you do surveys, you go into their store and ask specific questions, and you still can't get them involved.
Well, the question I was going to ask you was just the kind of training that you did. You mentioned something about doing training with your merchants or people, which sort of goes along with this discussion, and that how do you get business owners to buy in to it. And I mean, I was really more thinking of just wanting to know how you did that training to get the work where everybody, if somebody stops, a tourist, traveler stops at the motel, that whoever's working there is going to be able to say, oh yeah, there's this going on this weekend.
I can give you a concrete example of how I did it in one instance. And it was literally, there's a little small gift shop there in town called Pine Mountain Gifts, and it's kind of a dainty little gift shop. My wife will shop there, okay?
You wouldn't?
Well, it's not. I'd walk in there if I'm buying something for my wife. But she carries luggage lines, and so, you know, she does some neat stuff. It's a neat little business. But I was trying to talk to her about the trail town issues. I said, Trina, you need to get a bicycle rack out of here. Why? Well, so these bicyclists are stuck. I said, well, they're not. She said, well, they're not going to buy anything off me. They can't haul these things on a bicycle off. I said, but you can ship them to them. Well, why would they do that? I said, well, they might if you put a sign up that said, Transamerica Trail Riders, all orders over $50 shipped for free. And I said, why don't you think about that and try that? Try it the next one that comes in. Say, hey, by the way, we ship for free if you want to get something. Well, this was last summer. She did it. Her business doubled in a month off those bicycles. Okay? Because anybody, and there's a lot of Europeans too that ride that trail, okay? Anybody that's got enough time to ride a bicycle across the United States, okay? They've got some money.
They have money, and they have 10,000 followers.
Right.
Watching them on Facebook.
That's right.
And those followers want to know what towns.
Right.
And where they received hospitality, and they will tell them.
Right.
And that's the best form of advertising.
It is.
And that cost her nothing for those 10,000 impressions.
Right. This is kind of a little tip. If you go out to Google Alerts, I always use Google Alerts to tell me about Elkhorn City Transamerica Trail. Okay? So I get the hits. So once a week I'll get the hits back from these bicyclist blogs. And they'll tell it like it is. They'll tell you the good, and 70% of it's good, and they'll tell you how I got chased by three dogs and ran over by a coal truck. Okay? And then you can take those things, those concrete ideas, and take them to merchants too. So, but now the Trail Town Project they've got merchant workshops.
Yeah.
They've got specific workshops. But if you can tell them, if you can show them concretely, and that's the only way I know, is to find a concrete example.
You got to show them the money.
Yeah, you got to show them the money. Now we have, I'll be brief, I have as a nonprofit, there's a fellow who owns a piece of land by the river out in Elkhorn that he was just not using. He had these big ideas of a campground, horse ring, all this stuff, but to tell you the truth, he just didn't have the wherewithal to do it. So we went to him as a nonprofit and said, why don't you let us lease this for a weekend and we'll have a rendezvous out here for the boaters, okay? Sure. So we lease it as a nonprofit. We've got a lease on it for a month in October. I get the county in there to do the weeds. You know, I can do that. It's legal. We're a nonprofit. I get the county to work the road. I get the county to spruce it up a little bit to help us. And then we have these events out there. And he starts seeing, wow, you know, I can do something with this property. So now all my good work's coming back to haunt me. Because we're getting ready to have a festival and he wants $1,000 for the So, but that's good. Because he actually sees the potential. So you can't take your nonprofit. If somebody's got a hard asset that you think can be done something with, if you can figure out a way to do it through your group, and that's way you can use nonprofit stuff to get try to kick a business going. Because one thing they'll do, if they see you do it, they will do it. It's got to be proven.
I think sometimes you have to stimulate some like healthy competition between businesses too. I used to live in a community called Elkins, West Virginia. It's in the eastern mountain counties, and the businesses were going through an on-track process trying to become a main street. And so a lot of that comes down to uniformity of things, signage, and they want a lot of things to look the same. Some businesses didn't like that. They wanted to still have their unique look. So when they were talking about installing bike racks, then they have contests to see who can come up with the most creative bike rack out in front of the business. So they had like a hardware store, for example, that made one out of PVC pipe. And they had a little store like the one you were talking about that sells Vera Bradley bags. And so they painted their bike rack in a Vera Bradley pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to still have the uniqueness of their business. And then there was a competition involved with it. So there was an incentive for them to bikers.
And I was thinking about, we were having a meeting at Natural Bridge State Park, and someone went around, and they were serving us food, and someone went around to be sure to go online and review Natural Bridge State Park and tell like on Yelp or Urban Spoon and say what you think of the food here, because when people come through, and this is what I do when I'm in a new town, I go to Google reviews or Yelp, and I see where are people eating. And if there's no, if I'm driving through some place and I don't see any restaurant that have good reviews, I'll just keep on going until I find some place that does, because, you know, they're not always accurate, but it's better, you know, it's something to go on. So, and I think it's also really important to get local people, because that's what people, you know, a lot of tourists, where are the locals eating? And I think that's something to encourage in your communities for tourists as well as locals, and I think it also kind of builds that healthy competition.
I think it's important too that the local businesses get themselves listed,
right.
That they make sure that they're listed, the information that is listed is correct,
mm-hmm.
and that people can find them, because if somebody's driving through, especially tourists, and they don't know where to go, they're not going to find them. So, I think that's
I'm from Asheville, and I know it's a different story in Asheville, but one of the things that downtown did was for Black Friday, all the businesses got together and they made this t-shirt that was like, put your heart where your money is or something, buy local. And all the businesses wore the same t-shirt to support buying local. And, you know, this one weekend they didn't distinguish themselves as being, you know, a separate business competing against other ones, but they kind of unified around this campaign. And the profits went up. And it was just, you know, really collaborative marketing.
You know, she mentioned buy local programs, and those are keys too. We've had a lot of success of, you know, people will rally around, well, people will rally against something a lot more than they'll rally for something. Okay? So if you can get them to rally against Walmart and run a shop local campaign, you can actually make some, you can educate some local merchants with that, because they all understand that. They all know what Walmart has done to the downtown. And that's how you can get some of your businesses to actually work together and start a shop local.
And sometimes the best person to talk to a business person is another business person. They will, you know, in the context of chamber or Rotary or something, or a local organization like this, where they talk to each other and they offer programs to each other. And I just remember in Marion County, the chamber there started a program where they call it kind of like, if only I had known this before I started my business discussions. And they were from small business persons who had started as entrepreneurs. But instead of the typical, oh, this is how I exceeded, you know, they gave a talk about, oh, I wish I would have known these things before I started. Let me save you some of my agony by telling you some warning signs or things to think about or things to do. And they were getting, you know, 15, 20 people come to those, where before the other ones, they were only getting like 3 or 4 people to come. But we listen to people who are like us. So Teresa's a business person, I'm a business person. She comes to talk to me about something about business. I'm going to listen to her a little bit more than I will somebody else.
Isn't that kind of one of the issues that we have in interfacing government with business, that the leadership development models that we've had have been capitalistic models, that it's all about competition and being the strongest, and it's not about collaboration. And so our government models are based on that. It's all about competition. And we race to the bottom, giving out incentives for businesses and all these different things. How do we get the nonprofits and the people that are developing citizen activists to say, this is part of the model that makes collaboration work. This is how we work together and move beyond this simple capitalistic model.
That's a $64,000 question. You're a good professor,
Lori. Dump it on Lori.
I think we have some that get it, but you still have, I think, you know, particularly with politicians, I think that a lot of times they still think that in rural areas, you know, it's the big factory or the big, you know, one that we bring in, but it's the little guy that keeps it going, you know, the little business person.
it's their leadership. It's the politicians' leadership development model that taught them what they know.
But it's the electorate that's elected. They know what gets them votes. They know if they talk about, I'm going to get a factory that's going to build a widget in here, and it's going to create jobs. Well, we all know that's BS, because the widgets are built a lot cheaper in China. And everybody that wants that job is going to buy that Chinese widget and then complain about it on the way back from Walmart. You know? So there's an education component, and it's, people are starting to get it. You know, and I thank God for social media. People are starting to get it, and maybe that's part of it. You know,
I don't know if they actually did it, but I know that in Cynthiana, it was a citizens group that started. It was Harrison County Tomorrow, and they were tired of waiting for local government to do their thing. But they had part of their strategic plan was a buy local. What they wanted to do, and I know they got the money for it, and so I suspect it got done. I just hadn't gone back to find out for sure. They were going to put up a billboard facing into town as you leave town, because most everybody left town to go to Scott County to get shot. And they were going to put up on little facts. For every dollar you know you spend in Cynthiana circulates X amount of times. And then for every dollar you spend in Scott County, Cynthiana gets zero. And they were gonna catch people with a billboard driving out of town to say, do you want to think about that drive? Not, you know. But this issue of competition and collaboration, I have heard it working with farmers markets. In struggling with the issue of who do we allow to sell in our market? And sometimes people said, well, Lori said, I'm Lori, I sell tomatoes. I don't want Teresa here selling tomatoes, and I sure don't want Teresa and Amelia here selling tomatoes, because that's just going to make it worse for me. They don't understand until they visit another one where they're doing it, or they make the change and swallow it there, that the more vendors you have, the more customers you have. Because if you have five vendors and they run out at 8:30, at 7:30 in the morning, everybody figures that out, and if you're not up at 7 a.m. to come, they're not going to come at all. But if there's enough vendors to be able to have food, you know, goods there to sell at 8:30 and 9, you're going to have crowds. And they'll, you know, so more vendors, this kind of more competition is actually better in a farmer's market, because it produces a higher payoff and a larger, and isn't that what Walmart does, right? Isn't that the philosophy of Walmart?
Can I add to that, sir? What is your name?
Ray Tucker.
Ray, to answer your question about collaboration and competition, I'm a former contractor, an Energy Star builder who just got pushed out by a bad market. I went into energy conservation contracting, and Kentucky Home Performance came along. And Kentucky Home Performance brought a huge group of contractors together that would normally be competing and bad-mouthing each other, put them on a database, and linked them up, because you can't do whole house performance as an HVAC company without a partner in air sealing and insulation. And it wasn't the fact that they were competing over one customer at the beginning. It was also the fact that one customer got to experience something they had never experienced before, and that was satisfaction from their heating and air system. And it really wasn't necessarily because of the heating and air contractor, it was because of the whole house approach. So we had created something that was different, and it created more customers, and that grows and builds and begins to encourage other people to get into business. And then, of course, you had to have testing and third-party verification. So more business people and more opportunity came. And so as those, there are collaborations, and I would just say, let's tell the story. So that's why I told this one.
Christine?
I have a brief comment and question. I work as a facilitator and coordinator for something in Virginia, Southwest Virginia, called the Clinch River Valley Initiative, and it's kind of similar. It's four counties coming together, very grassroots ideas came up. Now there are five goals and vision and a youth component. And there's a consensus-based steering committee made up of a bunch of different folks. They decided to come up one of the counties, Scott County, actually adopted a resolution of support for this multi-town county initiative. But the whereas is a very formal, they just did it. And they also, their private grant, federal grant, small grants, and then asked, there was a request for the funding from localities to support $1,000, $5,000, $10,000. And the steering committee said, well, let's formalize this resolution of support and open it up to anybody, citizens, nonprofits, localities, towns. And it is amazing who has signed on. And we just keep a running tally on the website of who has signed on to supporting this initiative. And most of the counties, four counties have signed on, and towns, board of supervisors that usually don't like to talk to one another have signed on. Activists have signed on with economic developers. So it's been an interesting example of how to build support and, you know, rising high. And looking at how the potential economic benefit while preserving kind of peace centered in ecological areas, but promoting economic development, that collaboration will really benefit multiple communities. And that's been kind of the notion of thinking like the partnership's been a little different for some of the communities, but it's been really exciting for a lot of them. So that's been that's been really awesome to witness what that, even just that resolution support has done. And so my question for the panelists are your biggest challenge, your biggest lesson learned, I guess. You've addressed it to some degree, but what's the thing was there something that like let the floodgates open? Or was there something you said, was there a moment when you had that like community member who signed on? Or was there an event, it could be getting, you know, when you found the chlorine and the cafe, you know, what was the moment you said, wow, we got it? Or we're there, or whatever it may be.
Literally, when we were doing the Blue Line Trail Park project, we had some big gravel come from the quarry, and a Japanese artist was working on some sculpture benches. I couldn't get a hold of the mayor, so we put him in anyway. I called it guerrilla art. He called me. I'm assistant Commonwealth attorney for the county at the time. I'm running this group. The mayor calls me on my way to Powell to try a case. What's going on with these damn sculptures? Somebody's going to go to jail. And I said, well, mayor, I guess it's going to be me. Come on down. And at that point, he stuttered, and I knew I had him, okay, at that point. And it's not, from that point on, he bought on, you know, because it was so absurd. I said, I guess you're going to have to take me to jail. You weren't here, we did this. I don't advise people to do that. You've got to know your community, you've got to know your players. You gotta know if you can get out of jail. You know, a lot of things.
I'm no good lawyer, too.
Yeah, man. But, and I have to say, I honestly, in a way, that mayor was one of the best mayors we had. But we just had to keep running at him until he saw the benefit of what we were doing. He was one of these people that started bitching when they saw the blue. There was nothing he could do about it because the blue was on a private business that agreed to do it. So when we broke through that Blue Line Trail project, when we broke into breaking him down and getting, we got a really good push from that on.
I think for us, with the CPR group, one of the things was whenever we had the group for the Trail Town Initiative, the task force that came together, we had a meeting where we had our senator, we had two state parks represented there, we had adventure tourism, we had about 36 people to come to this meeting where we were lucky to maybe get 8 or 10 people at different meetings. So it was like all of a sudden, this really has impact, people are interested in it, and you know, we want to tap into this and make sure we get, you know, they're on board now. Let's keep them on board and we can keep, you know, growing this. You know, I think that was big. And to bounce that off of, whenever we had our final report, Lori came to present a final report of all of our forums. What do we have? 6 people there? 8? I don't know, 6 or 8 people total at Carter Cave State Resort Park in a big meeting room, and no public officials came. no public official from our county, no council person, no county fiscal court people, nobody. And you know, they really need to be there to hear that. This is the things that are going on in your community. These are the things that are good. These are the things that are bad. And these are the things we need to work on and that people think we need. No one. So we, of course, we, you know, presented the report and sent it to them, but you know, I don't, you know, who knows if they read it. So that whenever we got the Trail Town Initiative, was like, we've got, because we had the mayor there, we had county judge was there. It was, they bought in. And it was from the same group. I mean, that was two, the presentations were from the same group, just at different times. The Trail Town Task Force came later.
I think for us, as far as challenge goes, there's not sort of one big hurdle that's ever been specific in that way, but there's a kind of an ongoing tension and constant challenging dynamic around the issue of coal and Friends of Coal and our relationship to that, which we've very resolutely and very intentionally never had a relationship with that. We've never put ourselves into that dialogue one way or the other. But by the perception of who people think that we are, there's been a lot of that imposed on us. And in the question about competition, the other bar in town, which is literally directly across the street from us, is very, very much framed themselves as the Friends of Coal Bar and makes a point to let everybody know that we aren't. Which is just discouraging and frustrating, but it's, you know, it is what it is. But I think that there's a lot of challenge in the community at every level, not just in the business community, around that question, around that issue. Someplace that there's an enormous amount of struggle, just even internally within people. So we had it was the summer of 2011, we had been in a complicated legal battle with the state around alcohol sales issues, and which we eventually resolved in our favor, but it was just incredibly draining, and there was compounded by a serious family illness at that point, and we decided that we were going to close. We couldn't do it anymore at that point, and announced it. And within hours, much less days, there was just an enormous outpouring of support in the community in a way that I had no idea that existed. I had no idea that was there for us. And it was, you know, a Facebook page was formed. It was 2,000 people joined it, and, you know, and pushed and just said, no, you can't. You don't get to close. So we figured out how to not, with a lot of help from a lot of people at that point. And, you know, and thank God that that's the way it happened, because now at this point I can't imagine that we could have ever closed. But it's amazing to have that.
A question. Particularly for you, Amelia, for the rest of the group too. Just particularly for you, Amelia, because I know that a lot of what's, when I understand the revitalization in Whitesburg is around new bars, there's a tattoo parlor, there's a lot of, you know, what some people might find, you know, this strange or alternative, and, you know, how is the community responding to that? Is it positive? And are similar things happening, you know, where in Elkhorn City, in Olive Hill, where, you know, some of the new businesses that are coming in might not be the kind of businesses that the older generation, the more traditional folks who want it to be the 60s, you know, they're not the kind of businesses that they would hope it would be. But how is that relationship happening, or how is that reaction?
I think in Whitesburg, I mean, I'm sure there are people who furrow their brow about it, but they don't come to some city, so I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think there's you hear a lot of echoes of what people's feelings and thoughts about it are, and there's a sense of, you know, maybe I don't want to get a tattoo, or maybe I don't want to go get a beer, but I'm glad something's there. I'm glad that there is something in those empty storefronts that wasn't there. And people, you absolutely hear visioning of, well, what if we could put this in there? You know, what if that was possible? And so I think that's the point that we're at development-wise, is people really starting to get that spark, because there were these sort of marginal or alternative kind of places that people started because they have a passion for being a tattoo artist, or because they have a passion for drinking good beer, and weren't particularly concerned with what the status quo around that was necessarily going to be. That's the front edge.
Don't forget to mention all those places are also art galleries. It's like
they are all
art galleries. The tattoo parlor art gallery, the bakery art gallery, and like this evening is art walk in Whitesburg. And so people are going to come out and go around and maybe they'll get a tattoo, but they're going to go in there and see the art.
And art crosses almost every family.
We had an initiative in a town in West Virginia that had a bunch of empty storefronts, and so people wanted to know what the community wanted to see in there. So they did these, they had these pre-printed like giant post-it notes that said "I wish," and they let people go around and stick those on different storefronts. "I wish this was." Now, granted, some of them were probably, you know, they had to be monitored a little bit, but it was then presented to like city council, county commission, the chamber, and the EDA, so that they could target when they were recruiting people to come. It wasn't just about recruiting box stores or extractive industry. It was targeting specific industry that the community wanted to see there. So that was just the way that they did it. I'm talking about that.
There's somebody back there who's been trying to say
and
something.
I'm like hidden in this corner.
Oh,
I
can see.
I just wanted to go back to the point that we made earlier about the need for further education and what some of those components might look like, because I think you're right, people are starting to get it, but it has to take, that education has to take place in so many other spaces. So when I'm teaching undergraduates at the University of Kentucky, right, I have to teach them to appreciate diversity and alterity. I have to teach them to value non-capitalist and capitalist economic practices the same. When I work with high school students, I teach for the Robinson Scholars Honors Program at UK. These are all students from Eastern Kentucky that come up for summer camp, and I teach the Appalachian history and culture component of that. You know, again, I'm teaching them to value both of those economic practices the same, and then they're going back to their communities and creating projects that foster diversity that's already taking place there. And then when I work with children and I work with social studies teachers, and I was so glad to hear you mention the importance of going out to work with children more, I try desperately to help social studies teachers teaching about the economy to find ways to discuss global commodity chains. And it's really important that we teach them about global production networks, because when I'm getting them for an introductory geography class, they have no idea where their clothing is made. And so that first week, I had them do a very basic assignment where they have to look at the tags in their clothing and bring back a note card, and we look at what countries produce the majority of students. But they're 18 by the time I'm getting to them to teach them global commodity chains. So that's something that has to be a component of this as well. So whenever we can reach out to teachers in our communities, I think we've got to be doing that too. And I just wanted to emphasize that point. It's got to be so many different places, so many different skills that this education has to take place.
Well, one more final thought. We're a little over time. We haven't kicked us out yet, so that's good, but probably should try to keep to schedule. So
I just want to say a word about capitalism, since it's come up a couple of times. And I think it's important that we keep in mind the distinction between corporate capitalism and individual capitalism. The corporate capitalism, where the source of the capital is divorced from the activity of the business in the hands of shareholders, and where the business is beholden to those shareholders to maximize the profit, usually at the expense of wherever, however, and whatever business is conducted, compared to the capitalism that's represented by locally owned businesses in our communities that are providing a service, and where the profits of those businesses are reinvested back into the communities. So it's the difference between locally owned businesses and non-locally owned businesses is one of the keys to building stronger local economies.
And to go back with your point, what he just said, we've got to teach children that profits are better than wages, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All these, but profits are better than wages. And you have to show these kids, if you've got a bike, buy another one, rent the second one. That's how you teach a kid to be an entrepreneur. And that's, you know, local capitalism at its best. And that's the key.
And we've lost that. Kids used to have paper routes,
right,
and stuff like that. We even let kids sell Girl Scout cookies anymore. I mean, the parents are selling the Girl Scout cookies. And we've got to reintroduce those concepts into our children.
Right.
There are youth entrepreneurship training programs that are out there. 4-H has one called 4-H Means Business. There's a youth entrepreneurship program being done in, I think, about 8 or 10 counties in Eastern Kentucky. There's a lot of it, but the idea is that I think that communities need to focus on creating places that of such value that people choose to live and visit. And that can be done in many ways.
It is.
Right, thank you so much, everybody. Thank you so much.
Yeah.